I next met with Dr. Terry King, and to begin, she discussed her current approach to management of the axilla.
I think the major development has really been the management of the axilla. We've seen the evolution of going from axillary node dissection to sentinel node biopsy for staging of the axilla in patients who are clinically node negative. We then went to omitting axillary node dissection in patients who were found to have 1 to 2 positive sentinel lymph nodes. And now we've moved to using sentinel node biopsy to stage the axilla in women that start with clinical N1 disease and have a good response to preoperative therapy. And in many cases, avoiding axillary node dissection in women who are found to have had a pathologic complete response in the node. So I think that it's been very exciting and a positive shift for our patients, but certainly the data can be somewhat confusing at times to sort of keep up with all these shifts and changes.
More specifically, you know, you see patients who have been managed by other physicians, you know, second opinions, I'm sure, a lot. What are some of the things that you see people doing that maybe are not optimal?
Well, it can be challenging sometimes to sort of, again, sort of discern what is a clinically node negative patient. Does that just mean physical examination of the axilla? Should all of these patients be having axillary imaging? Should we be biopsying things that we see on axillary imaging, even if the axilla is negative on clinical examination? And so because we really are trying to select patients to do less, to avoid axillary lymph node dissections, really clearly defining what the clinical presentation stage is and then being true to your algorithm for management is critically important.
So I wanted to ask you about a few papers that you've been involved with that I thought were interesting. The first, Annals of Surgical Oncology, routine use of Oncotype DX recurrence score testing in node-positive, hormone-receptor-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. The time has come. Can you talk a little bit about what you got into in that paper?
So the Oncotype test is, of course, well known and widely used in women with ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative breast cancer, and certainly has allowed many patients to avoid the morbidity of chemotherapy for no benefit. The use of the Oncotype test in node-positive patients is still somewhat controversial, and of course, we await the results of the RxPonder trial, which is randomizing node-positive patients based on recurrence score. But while we await those results, we have seen a body of data accumulating from so-called real-world data that suggests that the recurrence score in node-positive patients clearly does, in fact, identify a low-risk group that has very good disease-free outcomes with the use of hormonal therapy alone. So simply saying that, you know, if we believe in the biology of the Oncotype score, then there's no reason that that biology should not stratify node-positive patients in the same way that it stratifies node-negative patients. And so I do believe that it is time for clinicians to consider the use of the score in the node-positive population, again, to identify those that are very low risk and can avoid chemotherapy.
You know, one of the themes we're seeing a lot throughout oncology over the last few years is separating out the issue of prognostic assays as opposed to predictive. And, you know, this issue with node positive, and, you know, your medical oncology colleagues at Dana-Farber get into this a lot, Hal Burstein, Eric Weiner, et cetera, that there may be situations where actually there is a substantial risk, or what a patient might consider a substantial risk. They might consider even 5 or 10% substantial when it has those kinds of consequences. But the question is chemo going to help?
Right.
And, you know, it kind of seems like it doesn't. Is that your take?
Well, certainly the available data suggests that women in that low-risk group, whether you define it as less than 11 or less than 18, you know, the studies are variable in the node positives, but certainly seems that women in that low-risk group have excellent outcomes when treated with endocrine therapy alone. So if your five-year breast cancer-specific survival is 97 or 98%, it's hard to do much better than that with the addition of chemotherapy. So I think that it's really just allowing us to select very low-risk groups of patients.
Well, again, I guess what I'm trying to say is even if the risk is not that low, if the chemotherapy is not going to make it any lower, I mean, that's the purpose of this assay and the other assays, then what's the purpose of giving it? And you know, this biology versus anatomy thing is, you know, a longstanding story that relates to. It seems to me like we got another major piece of information along this line of the biology versus anatomy just in the ASCO meeting, where we saw some more data from Taylor X presented, but now looking at people with clinically higher risk, so kind of towards the direction of node positive. Can you talk about what they looked at there and what you think it means?
So the Taylor X trial is interesting. It's full of data that we're just really digesting, really looking for a subset of patients that may actually benefit from chemotherapy as opposed to a one-size-fits-all. So as we know in Taylor X, the overall study showed no benefit to chemotherapy in women with the recurrent score up to 25. But within that group, subsets stratified by age and menopausal status suggested that there may be a more substantial benefit for some subgroups than others. And so certainly in the women younger than age 50, we're now seeing sort of different cutoffs being applied where chemotherapy would be considered in the sort of 18 to 25 range, but with an informed discussion with the patient as to what that absolute benefit of chemotherapy might be. We're also seeing increased discussions of the use of ovarian suppression in the younger women with sort of intermediate risk scores, again, with the suggestion that perhaps some of the chemotherapy benefit in Taylor X might have been due to the actual ovarian suppression side effect of chemotherapy and not necessarily meaning that the patients need chemotherapy. So again, we continue to try to further stratify or identify subsets of women where more treatment might be beneficial and other subsets of women where certainly more treatment is not beneficial, and really getting into the sort of tailored era where we're using genomics as well as other variables to select therapy for patients.
What do we know about the reliability of genomic assays like the recurrent score on core biopsies as opposed to surgical specimens?
There have been several studies looking at the use on core biopsies and comparing it to surgical specimens, and really they're highly concordant. We use Oncotype on core biopsies if we are trying to determine if a patient who may be a borderline candidate for breast conservation therapy, maybe a borderline candidate for chemotherapy, and we want to get some assessment of whether this is going to be a high-risk patient or a low-risk patient before going to the operating room, we will frequently get an Oncotype on the core. And if that patient is high-risk, we will give them preoperative chemotherapy with the hopes that we will get some downstaging of the tumor and potentially the axilla, even though we know that we don't get a lot of pathologic complete responses in the ER-positive groups, you can still get some downstaging. And so if that patient has a high-risk recurrent score and she's going to receive chemotherapy regardless, there's really no disadvantage to giving that to her in the preoperative setting and trying to get some secondary surgical benefit out of it. So we feel very comfortable using the Oncotype on the core biopsy.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. We did a survey a couple years ago, I think you were involved with it, of both investigators and medical oncologists. And actually, at that point, about a third of them were using specifically the recurrent score in select situations in the neoadjuvant setting. The rest weren't. But for those who were, I think, like, for example, a patient who needed shrinkage to have breast conservation, for example. And, you know, I guess the logic there was, you know, even though we don't maybe have as much data in the adjuvant setting, you know, as you said, if you see a high score, okay, that's one thing, you can give them chemo. But then the question is, what do you do if there's a low score? Would you give them neoadjuvant endocrine therapy? And again, I don't know that this represents the majority of investigators, but what do you think about that strategy?
So we consider the strategy quite often. As you said, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy is not as widely used as neoadjuvant chemotherapy, but we are seeing more attention being paid to it, both in clinical trials as well as in routine clinical practice. Again, you don't expect to get a pathologic complete response when you use neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, but you can get some downstaging or shrinkage of the tumor. The challenge is that, you know, it takes much longer. So both physicians and patients have to be willing to have 6 months of therapy and wait 6 months before going to surgical management. How to manage the axilla in that situation is also sort of a data-free zone. We don't have a lot of data on management of the axilla after neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, and people extrapolate from the neoadjuvant chemotherapy trials, but I'm not really sure that that is the best thing to do. But we are actually looking at this right now in our own patients, trying to gather some information and some data about management of both the breast and the axilla after neoadjuvant endocrine therapy.
So I just want to run through a whole bunch of great papers that you're involved with. So relevant to that in this sort of, I guess, Terry King Journal Club, I saw an interesting paper, really interesting. I was curious about, always interested in what's going on up there in Boston. This was in the journal Oncologist, Impact of Genomic Assay Testing and Clinical Features on Chemotherapy Use After Implementing Standardized Testing Criteria. This is really a description of what you all have done at your own institution. So I'm really curious what you're doing and, you know, what happened as a result.
Sure. So one of the challenges, of course, in deciding in some of these controversial cases, do I want to use the recurrent score to make a treatment decision, or am I leaning towards treatment in this patient? And when multidisciplinary teams, when they get into these discussions about what to do, we often find that the recurrent score does become, you know, one of the most important predictors of their management. And so having that recurrent score in a timely manner to help make those treatment decisions becomes very important. So when I first arrived in Boston several years ago, they had done an analysis looking at the time it took patients to begin their adjuvant systemic therapy. So for those patients who were going to be treated, how many days passed between surgery and initiating treatment? And they were actually quite surprised that only about 50% of their patients initiated treatment within 6 weeks of surgery. And so they looked at factors that were associated with delays to treatment, and they found that actually the use of the Oncotype recurrence score was actually associated with a delay in getting to treatment. And so in an effort to try to have that information sooner so that clinicians and patients could use that information to make those treatment decisions, we initiated what we call reflex testing. We agreed upon a standard set of criteria for whom we would want the recurrence score. And then the surgeons became very important members of that team and those decisions. And we actually would take on the responsibility of ordering the recurrence score as soon as the pathology report was back for those patients that met that reflex testing, that reflex criteria. And when we looked at the baseline, so prior to initiating reflex testing versus after initiating reflex testing, and compared the time that it took to get the recurrent score result and the time that it took for patients to initiate systemic therapy, we saw a significant decrease in both of those measures, where now up to 75 to 80% of patients were initiating their chemotherapy within 6 weeks of surgery, and at baseline it had been only about 50%. So just by standardizing the process, creating a workflow, agreeing upon standardized criteria that everybody was going to want this information, and so let's just initiate this workflow to get this information in a more expedient manner for clinicians, resulted in an improvement in our overall quality of care. And it didn't actually change the overall percentage of patients that were receiving chemotherapy. So in the baseline state, about 15% of patients that met our criteria had received chemotherapy. And after initiating reflex testing, again, about 15% of patients received chemotherapy. When we looked at the characteristics of those patients that were receiving chemotherapy, the only thing that reflex testing changed was that we were using the recurrent score now more often in some younger patients that previously did not have Oncotype sent by their physicians. And we were using it in patients that had more multifocal or multicentric disease. So it opened up our ability, I guess, to send testing on more patients and to get that information back in a timely manner, but did not result in higher uses of chemotherapy.
You know, it's interesting. It seems like there'd be a real major quality of life benefit to get started early. You know, patients are anxious. This is a very critical moment for them. It may be delaying them getting back to work. So this is a really big, tangible benefit.
Yeah, it really does improve the overall quality of care. And yes, certainly helps patients. They have an expectation from the outset. They know that when we get that pathology report back, we tell them that we'll be reviewing it. And if they meet the criteria, we'll be sending this test. And then they have a nice timeline in their mind to know that when they do meet with their medical oncologist postoperatively, that that information will be available and they'll be able to have that discussion.
The next thing I was going to ask you was, before we get into sort of the specific criteria, I guess the one clinical criteria is that it's going to make a difference. In other words, if the patient's already decided, no matter what, they're not going to get chemo, then maybe. So is part of your workflow, it sounds like what you just described, you're letting the patient know that you do this?
Absolutely. And in our multidisciplinary model, we actually meet with the patients, the surgeons and the medical oncologists. We meet with the patients at their new consultation. So up front, they've met their entire team. And up front, they understand that we use this assay in appropriately selected patients to help guide these treatment decisions. Certainly, if a patient is not a candidate for chemotherapy, whether it's patient preference or whether it's comorbidities, you know, the oncologist will go through that type of decision making. And if a patient is not a candidate for chemotherapy, then there's less reason to use this assay if it's not going to influence your management. But oftentimes, again, even if patients say at the outset, you know, I won't take chemotherapy or I'm not going to do that, oftentimes the tool can still be helpful because it provides the patient with a little bit more granular information to be sure that they are comfortable with that decision.
Maybe they might consider, for example, a premenopausal patient more aggressive endocrine therapy too, even if they, you know, ovarian suppression, for example, with an AI or not. I'm kind of curious, as part of this plan that you've implemented, do you utilize other assays besides Oncotype?
So not routinely, but we have started in the context of another clinical trial. We are using the Prosigna assay. That's a clinical trial that we are, again, looking at how using that assay on a core biopsy might impact our treatment decisions with respect to preoperative chemotherapy versus preoperative endocrine therapy versus going straight to surgery. So in the context of that trial, we are using that assay, but we don't use it very frequently in sort of standard clinical practice at this point.
There's also the 70-gene assay. There was a big randomized MINDEC trial that looked at that. Any situations where you use that?
We have not been using that, no.
So yeah, I know your oncologists, I guess they tell us that in terms of the data that's out there, even though they think they're not sure there's that much difference theoretically, but I guess there is some. They don't really all come to the same exact kind of conclusion from what I've seen. Is that your take?
Yes, there are some nuances, I guess, in putting those data sets together and interpreting them. You know, one of the challenges with using the MINDEC results right now is how they categorize patients as high clinical risk and low clinical risk. And as you know, that tool, Adjuvant Online, is not available to us at this time. And so we would be extrapolating to sort of identify the high clinical risk, low clinical risk patients, and then applying MINDEC data with the 70-gene assay. I think the 70-gene assay, you know, partly I think because when it was first developed, it was only validated in fresh frozen tissue. And so I think that really limited the use of that assay in the United States for a lot of centers. And so we just didn't get the same level of familiarity using it as we did the recurrent score, since we could send that on FFPE tissue. And so whereas I know the 70-gene assay is certainly much more widely used in Europe, I think people just have less comfort and less experience with it in the United States.
So what are the criteria that you have this for reflex testing? I would guess there might be situations outside of that where, you know, a physician might elect to do an assay. But in terms of this sort of standardized reflex, what are the criteria?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So there's reflex, and then medical oncologists can certainly order the test outside of that. And the reflex, as we suggested, is really just to expedite the information. So when we first started back in January of 2016, our criteria were relatively selective because, again, this was the first effort to get all the medical oncologists to agree that these were the patients that they would consider using the assay in. So when we first started, it was T1C N0, grade 2 or grade 3 patients, T2N0, grade 1 or 2 patients, and T1T2N1, grade 1 or 2 patients. So those criteria, they're kind of hard to remember, but they reflect some of the what was the sort of inherent biases within our group going forward. So they did not want the recurrent score on patients with small tumors that had grade 1 disease. They didn't feel like that was going to impact their treatment making. And they were a little reluctant to use the recurrent score in grade 3 disease because they felt they were biased towards treatment in those patients. But at the same time, we were sort of ahead of the game as far as using the recurrent score in node-positive patients. After we looked at our initial experience over the first year or so of using the score and went back and identified the patients that had the score sent per the reflex criteria versus the patients who had the score obtained outside of those criteria, so what other situations were oncologists ordering the assay. And we identified a group of patients with grade 3 disease where, in fact, the score was being obtained and was being used outside of reflex, and demonstrated that in patients with grade 3 disease, that about 30% of them still actually have low-risk scores. And when we presented that data to our group and sort of went through the outcomes, how those patients were treated, et cetera, that opened up their, I guess, minds, if you will, to being more open to obtaining the score and using the score in grade 3 patients. So we then changed our reflex criteria to now include any grade of disease, with the exception of grade 1 small tumors. We still do not use it. But in T1C, N0, grade 2 or 3, T2, N0, any grade, and T1, T2, N1, any grade, now we obtain the score. Most recently, we've looked at our data in the node positive subset. And again, similar to the recurrent score identifying low-risk patients that have grade 3 disease, the recurrent score does very consistently identify low-risk patients that have node-positive disease. And we've been looking at our use of chemotherapy in that cohort and have found that the recurrent score does certainly impact whether our oncologists will give chemotherapy in patients with node-positive disease.
Somehow I was flashing on Atul Gawande, the New Yorker writer, the surgeon who writes about quality in medicine in the New Yorker. You know, he talks about like the Cheesecake Factory, and I was just thinking about your operation as really quality improvement.
We do spend a lot of time thinking about it, yes, and trying to identify ways that we can improve the quality of care that we're delivering. And Atul's actually a Brigham surgeon. We're very fortunate to have him in our department.
Anyhow, so I was actually just flashing on the fact that I was predicting when you said 15% of that whole group got chemo, and I kind of guessed, you know, what maybe your criteria was. I was thinking to myself, 95% of those people would have gotten chemo before these assays, right?
Well, certainly many more, yes.
many. I mean, again, for people who are kind of maybe just coming into the field, I think it was 2000. Remember, there used to be consensus conferences,
yes,
you know, before everything happened so fast. And they came out and said, any tumor over 1 centimeter needs chemo.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very different world now, thankfully, for our patients.
Yeah, what a huge difference. So there's another paper you have in Annals of Surgical Oncology, Surgeon Variability and Factors Predicting for Reoperation Following Breast-Conserving Surgery. Can you talk about what you looked at there?
Sure. Well, in breast-conserving surgery, one of our biggest challenges is obtaining clear margins. And before the consensus guidelines for what is the definition of a clear margin, there was a lot of variability amongst surgeons as to what they accepted as a negative margin width and when they would take someone back to the operating room for re-excision or not. We know from lots of published work that the re-excision rate in breast conservation therapy across the nation has been reported to be in the 20 to 30% range. And so certainly having to take back one of every three patients that you operate on is not ideal. The consensus guidelines on the definition of a negative margin for invasive breast cancer certainly resulted in a dramatic decrease in the number of patients going back for re-excision, with the definition of no tumor on ink as a negative margin. There was really no need for surgeons to go back for a more widely clear margin, so to speak. And so in that particular analysis, one of our residents was the first author, and she looked at the re-excision rates and return to the OR rates amongst the large group of surgeons at the Brigham. The time period that she studied was actually before my arrival. But there, again, was a wide variation, and that variation really reflected the time period where there wasn't a consensus on what defined a clear margin. Since that time, we, again, have continually to monitor our own data and our own outcomes. And with the adoption of the consensus statement for the definition of a negative margin, as well as some other measures that we've put in place to reduce some variability between surgeons, we've seen a dramatic decrease in our rates of returning to the operating room for re-excision, which now hover in the 10 to 15% range across our group of 11 surgeons. So again, it's important for us to collect our own data, monitor our own practice and our outcomes, and make sure that we are doing the best that we can for our patients.
Any sense of whether or not that message is fully permeated out into the community, the no ink on margin?
Absolutely. And Dr. Morrow has some data that she's been collecting. I believe actually it's been published now, but I've seen her present it, demonstrating that since the publication of the consensus statement, that not only have rates of re-excision decreased across the country, but actually rates of bilateral mastectomy have decreased across the country. So we know that when women have to return to the operating room for a re-excision, that that was one of the factors that has been associated with this uptake of bilateral mastectomy for unilateral cancer. And so it's been very nice to see that, yes, the adoption of this definition has resulted not only in decreased rates of re-excision, but has also starting to impact the rates of contralateral prophylactic mastectomy.
Again, quality life-wise, this is a great thing to be able to avoid. And even though the rates have gone down, do we know to what extent it actually has permeated into the community?
So in Dr. Morrow's work, she uses data from, I think it's the SEER data, where women and their surgeons are sampled across the country in a survey actually asking them about their practices. And so I do believe that her data demonstrates that it is getting out there and that surgeons in communities as well as major academic centers are seeing a shift in their practice.
So another sort of quality-related paper here, and this is from, Annals of Surgical Oncology, Multidisciplinary Management of the Axilla. You have a lot of papers related to that. As you said, that is maybe the biggest issue. In patients with CT1, T2, N0 breast cancer undergoing primary mastectomy, results from prospective single institutional series. What'd you look at there?
Sure. So with the results of Z11 and several other prospective trials demonstrating that women who are found to have 1 to 2 positive sentinel lymph nodes, that axillary dissection can be avoided without increased rates of regional recurrence or changes in disease-free survival or overall survival. We have seen a real shift towards adoption of those data and avoiding axillary node dissection. But the majority of people treated in those trials received breast conservation therapy. In fact, in Z11, 100% of patients received breast conservation therapy. But in the other trials examining the axilla in that same setting, we have the International Breast Cancer Study Group trial, which looks at patients with micromets in 1 to 2 nodes. We have AMOROS, which looked at use of axillary radiotherapy versus axillary node dissection in women with 1 to 2 positive nodes, and several other studies, but the majority of women in all those studies had breast conservation therapy. Only about 15 to 20% had mastectomy. So there still is a real question out in the community as to what is the best management of the axilla in patients who have a mastectomy and have 1 to 2 positive sentinel nodes, and can we avoid axillary node dissection in that group, either in favor of observation or in favor of axillary radiotherapy in addition to PMRT if a patient is going to get PMRT. So that's really what AMOROS did, was AMOROS randomized patients to node dissection versus axillary radiotherapy in the context of comprehensive either chest wall radiotherapy after mastectomy or whole breast radiotherapy after breast conservation. So in our group, we were interested in thinking about an algorithm that would avoid patients getting both. So if a patient was taken to the operating room, going to have a mastectomy, found to have positive lymph nodes, if that was a patient that our radiation oncologists were going to recommend post-mastectomy radiotherapy for, then we wanted to take the opportunity to use AMOROS criteria and have that patient receive axillary radiation in the context of their PMRT, as opposed to dissecting their axilla and then having them go get PMRT. So we came together as a group and again considered what the criteria would be for our radiation oncologists to use PMRT in that population. And once we had that consensus, as the surgical team, we said, okay, for these patients, we're no longer going to perform a frozen section on the sentinel node in the operating room, because we know that if our patients have 1 to 2 positive nodes, that there's a high probability they will receive post-mastectomy radiotherapy, and therefore they can receive axillary radiotherapy as opposed to axillary node dissection. We wanted to be very careful, again, to identify a group that had a lower nodal disease burden So we decided that anybody who was found to have three positive sentinel nodes, we would actually return them to the operating room for axillary node dissection. Those women were underrepresented in the AMROS trial, and so we wanted to still maintain optimal local regional management in those patients. So again, agreeing upon criteria for how we were going to select and manage this group of women having a mastectomy in the setting of early stage clinically node negative breast cancer, applying that criteria then prospectively, and then we looked at our first year experience to see, one, how well we were implementing it. Was it effective? Were patients open to not having a frozen section in the operating room with the possibility of perhaps having to go back for a node dissection? How well did our multidisciplinary team work together in identifying patients who would be candidates for post-mastectomy radiotherapy? And then how were these women treated? And so what we reported there in that first year were, I think, some very interesting findings and trends that can be informative for all of us. So I think the first and foremost was that among women with T1, T2, N0 breast cancer having a mastectomy, only 25% of them actually had positive sentinel nodes. So right there, we were sparing the frozen section, the extra time and cost in the operating room for 75% of women who were going to be node negative. In the 25% that had positive nodes, 95% of them only had one or two positive sentinel nodes. So again, we had a very small number of women that we actually had to take back because they had three or more positive sentinel nodes according to our algorithm. So we felt that that was reassuring right there. We were, again, avoiding unnecessary cost and time in the operating room on frozen section, but not at the expense of having to take a large number of women back because they had heavier disease burden. So then within the group that had one or two positive nodes, about 70% of those women did in fact receive post-mastectomy radiotherapy with axillary radiotherapy, again, a la AMOROS, for management of their positive axilla as opposed to having an axillary node dissection. A few women had just axillary observation because they had very limited micrometastatic disease in the sentinel nodes. And then a few women actually ended up going back for both axillary node dissection and having axillary radiotherapy because they were found to have a significant amount of disease. So we, again, were very happy with how this algorithm worked for our group in our patient population. But when you apply an algorithm like this, it really comes down to understanding what your radiation oncologist's threshold is for giving post-mastectomy radiotherapy. So we as a surgical group, we did not want to kind of push more women into that bucket. Certainly PMRT has its disadvantages, particularly in women getting reconstruction after mastectomy. So we wanted to be very clear and very careful that we were not going to put more women in the PMRT bucket simply because we did not dissect the axilla. We wanted to understand who was going to get it with or without dissection of the axilla so that we could then minimize, again, our treatments in favor of axillary radiotherapy.
So interesting. I was just thinking, I wish I could run my CME company the way you all run your breast department. It's really awesome. But it does remind me, too, that a lot of what we've done, and we even do this in quantitative surveys, is ask a lot of questions about what people do. Like, you're in this situation, what do you do? And then we take all that and you can construct algorithms, but you take it one step further, then you start looking at the data, you look at the results and you modify it. So it seems like a very dynamic system.
Well, that's part of the pleasure of working in a big multidisciplinary group and, enjoying what you do and being able to think about how you can do it better, all with the ultimate goal of having better outcomes for our patients. So.
But, this philosophy can be applied, to an individual in practice, too. I mean, that kind of that logic of looking at, I guess, your practice as a factory in terms of, sort of how it works. So continuing on, a couple more papers, and then we'll get to your cases. But this one was really interesting. I read this one. This is really interesting. I don't usually get the advances in anatomic pathology. But evaluation of the breast and axillary lymph node specimens in breast cancer patients treated with neoadjuvant systemic therapy, really timely, as we're going to talk about in terms of particularly in HER2-positive disease. But I just thought it was really interesting the focus here on the pathologic evaluation after neoadjuvant therapy. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that was a nice opportunity to work with one of my colleagues, Dr. Stuart Schnitt, who's a very well-known breast pathologist and a pleasure to work with. So when we're making, you know, surgical decision-making in the context of neoadjuvant chemotherapy is really dependent upon the reports that we get from our pathologists. And one of the things, again, when we're pursuing breast conservation after neoadjuvant chemotherapy is, again, the margin status, as well as how much tissue do we need to remove in someone whose tumor has shrunk with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. There's, you know, some disparate opinions out there. Do you need to remove the entire volume of the original tumor? Or do you need to remove a smaller amount? How do you decide? I'm personally of the belief that if you're downstaging a tumor with preoperative therapy, that you should then be removing a smaller amount, that you should not be removing the entire tumor volume, because that's the advantage of downstaging, is so that you can remove a smaller amount of tissue. But in order to be confident that you've adequately assessed the response, you need to have an understanding of, you know, pathologically, what does that tumor bed look like? We know that some tumors shrink very concentrically, and so it's very easy to feel confident that you, in taking a smaller volume, that you've adequately assessed the response and that you haven't left disease behind. But some tumors don't shrink concentrically and they get sort of a stippled appearance or a buckshot appearance where there still can be residual viable tumor throughout that tumor bed. And if you've taken only a small portion of that, then you may have in fact left disease behind. And so it's important, I think, for the surgeon to not only look at, oh, did I get clear margins or not, but to look at what the pattern of response is as described by your pathologist to decide if you're comfortable with your resection volume and comfortable that you've got clear margins.
What about pre-op, though? Because, you know, theoretically, you want to figure this out up front. Are there clinical clues? You know, I remember seeing diagrams that people had, what you just described. Does it just shrink together? Is it patchy? Is there a type of clinical scenario that would, you know, point you in one direction or the other?
So in my practice, in a patient that I am considering downstaging with preoperative chemotherapy, I do use MRI, both pre-treatment and then post-treatment, to get a sense of that type of response that the patient has had. There have been lots of studies trying to define what is the best imaging tool to look at patterns of response or to predict pathologic complete response after pre-op therapy. And although none of the tools are perfect, MRI does seem to have the highest correlation coefficient, if you will, with predicting size of the tumor after neoadjuvant therapy and the likelihood of a pathologic complete response. We are looking right now, again, retrospectively, in a cohort of patients treated at Dana-Farber, where we've already published on the rates of re-excision after neoadjuvant therapy, which is a little different than, you know, re-excision in the upfront surgery setting. Again, there is no consensus statement that says what is a negative margin after neoadjuvant therapy. Is no tumor on ink good enough, or do you need 1 millimeter? Do you need 2 millimeters? So we did publish a small retrospective series from our population showing that there was no difference in rates of local recurrence at 5 years based on margin width, that no tumor on ink seemed appropriate in this population, again, that were managed by the physicians at the time. But we're now going back, and Dr. Schnitt is actually reviewing all of those cases, and we're trying to categorize really the pattern of response to try to get an idea, does pattern of response predict for outcome at all? There was a very old and small paper from the MD Anderson group many years ago suggesting that perhaps that patients that have that stippled pattern of response, that perhaps they have inferior outcomes to patients that shrink concentrically. But there's really very little known about the importance of the pattern of response. So we're interested in it both with respect to making sure that we are making good surgical decisions and making sure that we get an adequate assessment of the tumor bed, making sure we get clear margins, but also looking at, does it have any prognostic significance?
So a couple other papers I want to ask you about, and then we'll get to our cases. I see you had a paper at the last San Antonio meeting last December with Ann Partridge, who's really been a leader in terms of breast cancer in younger women, surgical treatment after neoadjuvant systemic therapy in young women with breast cancer, a prospective cohort study. How about that?
Yeah, so the young population is certainly a population that we like to focus on. We want to make sure that, again, our treatments that we give to our young women, that we're optimizing their quality of life at the same time as we're optimizing their survivorship. And so young women are more likely to present with larger tumors. They're more likely to present with high-risk biology. And so therefore, preoperative chemotherapy is often considered in young women. We, again, know that young women also are more likely to opt for more aggressive surgery, and we see higher rates of contralateral prophylactic mastectomy in our young women, even in the absence of positive genetic testing. And so those two facts are a bit in contrast to each other. So if young women are more likely to get preoperative chemotherapy, more likely to have actually a nice response to that preoperative chemotherapy, and then become good candidates for breast conservation, yet we're still seeing young women choose the more aggressive surgery when we know that there's no survival benefit to the more aggressive surgery. So we were really just, again, looking at the factors that predicted for the use of pre-op therapy and then looking at how the use of pre-op therapy impacted rates of breast conservation versus mastectomy versus bilateral mastectomy.
So you had so many great papers. I was reading all these, and I can't remember which one it was. I thought I saw something about genomic assays being incorporated into staging systems now.
Yes. So the recurrence score is actually incorporated into the 8th edition of the AJCC staging system. So the 8th edition of the staging system, which went into effect in 2018, now incorporates tumor biology. So it's no longer just the T, N, and M factors that go into staging, but now the staging system incorporates tumor grade as well as ER, PR, and HER2 status to come up with the patient's prognostic stage. So again, we know how much tumor biology impacts prognosis and how we use it to make treatment decisions. And so now that information is in the staging system. Because of the very consistent data, again, demonstrating excellent outcomes in patients with low-risk recurrence scores, and in this context, low-risk was defined as less than 11, again, based on the Arm A of the TAILOR-X trial, the staging system now says that for any patient with a T1, T2, N0, ER-PR positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, and a recurrence score of less than 11, that patient is automatically a prognostic stage 1A patient, whereas in the past, you know, T2, N0 made you automatically stage 2. But now if you're T2, N0 and have good biology, you're actually downstaged by using the recurrence score. So this new edition, the 8th edition of the staging system, again, another example of how we're really incorporating biology to not only tailor treatments, but to better refine prognosis for our patients.
I know when I saw that, I've got to say it was like really weird. It was like a disconnect, like it downstages them to 1A, you know, it's almost like analog meets digital age, so to speak. You know, here you have at ASCO, you have basically a trial looking at a genomic assay, the TAILOR-X style, that now starts to factor in the clinical factors. And on the other end, you have the staging people who are trying to bring in the genomic assay. It's like somehow they're trying to come together, which I guess they do, except I still am kind of wondering, like, what really is this? You know, again, you might have a bad tumor, you might have a bad prognosis, but that doesn't mean chemotherapy is going to help.
That's true. And it goes both ways. So in the new staging system, now if you have a T1, N0 triple negative breast cancer, that your prognostic stage is actually stage 2. So all T1, N0s used to be stage 1, but now incorporating that biology, it also upstages some people. And so it's really just better refining prognosis with the current staging system.
I don't know. I can imagine somebody driving along the road in the United States or anywhere else listening to this kind of going like, what? You know? Anyhow, it just kind of strikes me as kind of strange, but I guess we'll see how it plays out over the succeeding years. So I want to get into some of your cases here. And we've been talking a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy. And I want to actually start out talking about HER2 positive disease, because that's really where a lot of things are happening in terms of neoadjuvant, let's say systemic therapy, in terms of changes. You've talked about these other things in terms of the axilla that have been percolating along for a few years. But now HER2 positive disease has really changed a lot. And maybe to get into that, you can talk a little bit about this 47-year-old woman that you saw.
Sure. So as you suggested, the HER2 positive subset has received a lot of attention, which is very good for our patients. There are many more agents that are available now for the HER2 positive group, and we're using more of them in the preoperative setting, and we're seeing very high rates of pathologic complete response. So this an example from my practice, a 47-year-old who presented with the clinical T2N0 ERPR negative HER2 positive invasive ductal cancer. We know that this subset in particular, the hormone receptor negative HER2 positive group, has very high rates of pathologic complete response. And so these patients we routinely treat with pre-op therapy. And so this patient we actually treated on a clinical trial that we're running called DAPHNE. And in this study, patients receive THP, so trastuzumab and pertuzumab, on the chemotherapy backbone of just Taxol. And they receive THP times 4. And then we repeat their imaging. Again, as I suggested earlier in my practice, I like to use MRI both pre-treatment and post-treatment to give an assessment of response. And if someone looks like they've had a complete radiographic response, if they've had a complete clinical response, then we proceed to surgery. And this patient did, in fact, have that. We performed a lumpectomy and a sentinel node biopsy. Her sentinel nodes, we did test them intraoperatively, and all three were negative. So we did not do a lymph node dissection. And then her final pathology came back with a pathologic complete response in the breast. And again, three negative nodes on final pathology. And so on this clinical trial, patients who receive a PCR with simply the THP preoperatively, they do not get any additional systemic chemotherapy postoperatively. They simply go on to continue their antibody therapy for a year. So we're identifying women who achieve a PCR with antibodies and a very limited amount of chemotherapy, and then eliminating the additional chemotherapy out back. So a de-escalation scheme, if you will, for that HER2 positive subset that has an excellent response. And this is something that we are seeing more and hearing more about. And there's actually a very large trial being designed now within the cooperative groups to test this concept in a much larger population of women.
I think it's really important for the surgeon to know about, because, you know, I know usually you leave things up to the oncologist, but this is really an important quality of life, again, quality of life issue. And your institution piloted the use, you know, Sarah Tulaney had a trial in the adjuvant setting where paclitaxel was used instead of docetaxel. And most oncologists find paclitaxel much better tolerated. So it's a big difference. But the big neoadjuvant trials use docetaxel. So I think this is really important that you've demonstrated this kind of efficacy and a much more, I mean, what do you see when you see people getting paclitaxel pre-op as opposed to docetaxel? Can you see a difference?
Oh, absolutely. Patients experience far fewer side effects. Many patients come back in after, you know, receiving their THP pre-op, and you can't even tell that they've been on, you know, they don't have the appearance of being a chemotherapy patient. So it seems very well tolerated. And it's really, again, as you said, it's very important for the surgeon to be part of that team and that decision making preoperatively to understand what the criteria are going to be to decide that a patient will not get chemotherapy out back if they've had this PCR, but to also be able to say, hey, this particular patient, she didn't have as good of response as we would have liked with THP. I know you're going to give her more chemotherapy, so let's go ahead and do that before we go to surgery so we can get the maximum benefit from that pre-op therapy as far as our surgical outcomes. So again, we love to identify the women who aren't going to need more treatment. But as a surgeon, I think it's very important to stay involved in that decision-making, because if this particular patient, again, if that MRI after THP still showed significant residual disease in the breast, or, you know, potentially residual disease in the nodes, then I would have had a conversation with my medical oncology colleague, and I would have said, if I take her to surgery now, she has not had a PCR, so therefore I know you're going to recommend AC out back. So instead of doing that out back, let's do that before surgery so I can give her the maximum benefit of downstaging the breast and the axilla.
Of course, the big development that occurred at the San Antonio meeting last December that really changed things dramatically for these patients was the so-called Catherine study that looked at the antibody-drug conjugate, T-DM1. And again, your center has really had a leading role in developing this therapy used in patients with residual disease compared to what's usually used, which is trastuzumab, or a lot of times people use the two antibodies she got, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And T-DM1 looked a lot better and seemed to be very well tolerated. What's your experience been? Have you all switched over to that strategy at this point?
We have. I mean, certainly it's always an individualized decision making with the physician and the patient, but we certainly are using much more T-DM1 for patients with residual disease with the results of Catherine. And again, for the surgeon, it really highlights the importance of what we do to make sure that if a patient has residual disease, that we identify it. And I say that in the context of really the management of the lymph nodes. So particularly in that patient who starts out node positive, looks like they've had a great response to preoperative therapy, we offer them a sentinel lymph node biopsy. We know that the sentinel lymph node biopsy in the setting of starting out with node positive disease, we know that there's a higher false negative rate in that setting than in the clinical N0 setting. And so we really need to be very diligent and thoughtful about when we accept the results of our sentinel node procedure as being node negative in these patients that potentially have residual disease. Because if we don't find that disease for our medical oncologists or for our patient, then they're going to not have the benefit of getting that T-DM1, for example, for residual nodal disease.
So I guess just maybe taking a more global look at neoadjuvant therapy, it seems like the trigger for neoadjuvant therapy in general is very, very low for HER2-positive disease, but also triple-negative disease. Is that, again, your approach if you see a patient with 1.5 or 2 or 2.5 centimeter tumor that's triple-negative, are you going to be given neoadjuvant therapy?
I would say that we have a little bit higher threshold for giving neoadjuvant therapy in the triple-negative patient, simply because if the patient is already a candidate for breast conservation therapy without preoperative treatment, we know that we can go to the operating room, do a lumpectomy, do a sentinel node biopsy. If that patient only has one or two positive sentinel nodes, we can avoid lymph node dissection. Whereas after pre-op chemotherapy, if we go to the operating room and find residual disease, they're going to get an axillary node dissection regardless of how much disease is there. So if a patient is already a candidate for breast conservation, 1 centimeter, 1.5 centimeter triple negative tumor, appropriate size breast, we would more likely be taking that patient to upfront surgery. But certainly if a patient with triple negative disease is anywhere on the borderline of being a conservation patient or has a larger tumor or clearly has node positive disease, then yes, we treat triple negative patients very commonly with pre-op therapy.
Just to finish out on this patient, this 47-year-old lady, how did she do with the neoadjuvant therapy? Did she lose her hair? How did she feel?
She actually didn't. She did remarkably well. She had a minimal neuropathy that started towards the last cycle of the Taxol, but nothing significant, and she's doing very well postoperatively now, and that neuropathy has resolved.
So we were talking about triple-negative disease, and I see you have a 35-year-old woman who presented with T2N1 triple-negative breast cancer. What happened there?
Yes, so T2 disease, young woman, relatively small breast. So that plus the fact that she was N1, we elected to proceed with pre-op therapy.
She had palpable nodes or ultrasound or what?
Palpable.
How big?
Yes. Only about 1 centimeter, but clearly abnormal on physical exam. So she received dose-dense ACT. During that time, she did have panel testing, and she tested negative for hereditary predisposition genes. And we saw her back at the end of her chemotherapy. She'd had a good clinical response. The axilla was now clinically negative. I could no longer feel the palpable lymph node. And the tumor in the breast had also shrunk quite nicely. But on MR imaging, there was still evidence that she probably was going to have some residual disease there. But she certainly became a good candidate for breast conservation therapy. So we performed a lumpectomy. We performed sentinel lymph node mapping. And in this situation, when patients start out N1, we do mandate the use of dual tracer, both blue dye and isotope, to increase our likelihood of not only identifying the nodes, but also to decrease the false negative rate. We also, in this setting, we as a group, have mandated that we need to identify three true sentinel lymph nodes and that all of those sentinel lymph nodes need to be negative for us to avoid dissection. There's a lot of discussion about this, again, in the community about making sure that we minimize the false negative rate. And we know from the clinical trial of ACOZOG Z1071, Centina, and others that the identification of at least three sentinel nodes was associated with a much lower false negative rate than when fewer sentinel nodes were removed. So we use dual tracer. We ensure that we've identified three nodes. In this case, we did. And on intraoperative analysis, her nodes were negative, so we did not do a dissection. Her final pathology, though, came back with about 5 millimeters of residual disease in the breast and a micromet in one of those three sentinel lymph nodes. And so this raises, again, the question of what is the importance of low-volume residual disease micromets in the sentinel node after preoperative therapy. And that's prognostically different than finding a micromet in the upfront surgery setting. In the upfront surgery setting, that micromet truly is low-volume disease, and we know that it doesn't impact long-term outcomes. But after preoperative therapy, that micromet is the residual disease. It was bigger, it was a macromet, and now what's left is a micromet. And so we return those patients to the operating room for lymph node dissection unless they're on clinical trial, where the clinical trial that was open was the Alliance trial, which randomized patients with still having positive nodes to axillary radiotherapy versus axillary dissection. But outside of a clinical trial, we feel very strongly that patients with any residual disease after preoperative therapy need an axillary node dissection. So we went back, dissected her axilla, and removed an additional 12 nodes. And overall, she ended up having 2 out of 12 nodes that were positive. So again, here's a patient that important to identify that residual disease. We know that capecitabine in this setting is used quite frequently for patients with residual disease. And so making sure that as surgeons that we are optimizing our technique for sentinel node in this setting, we're identifying that residual disease and that we are managing it appropriately and helping our medical oncology colleagues make those subsequent treatment decisions.
So kind of curious, I see that she had, I guess, BRCA testing or genetic testing. How long does it take to get back? And you wait until you get it back? And at what age do you do that?
Yes, so we offer genetic testing to almost anybody with breast cancer who's interested in genetic testing now. The criteria for testing certainly have broadened with the use of panel testing, and we're identifying women that do have inherited predisposition genes that don't really meet the standard NCCN criteria for going to testing. So we do quite a bit of testing among all ages of women, but certainly in the triple negative young patient, we're concerned about possibly a BRCA mutation. So we offer these patients panel testing. In this patient, it would be a more abbreviated panel because we really are looking for those high penetrance genes. And that usually takes about 10 days turnaround time for us to get the first sort of abbreviated panel of the most likely genes to be involved. And then if there's an indication to go on to further testing after that, then that sort of extended panel does take a couple of more weeks. So if in a patient who the patient feels confident that if she has a mutation that she's going to elect a different surgical procedure, then we will wait that 10 days to 2 weeks for that result to come back. If the patient says, I'm not confident that I would change my mind about my surgery, I may need more time to think about it, then we may go on to surgery before that result comes back. But in general, you know, it takes us a couple weeks to get our patients into the operating room anyway, so we have that window to get the first panel back of the most commonly mutated genes. And certainly in someone receiving preoperative therapy, you have several months to get that information back and for the patients to process it and determine how it's going to impact their thinking about their surgical management.
If you knew the patient had a BRCA germline mutation, this patient with triple negative disease, what exactly would you have done?
So we would have counseled her that her risk of in-breast recurrence for the ipsilateral breast would be higher over time, and we would counsel her regarding her risk of contralateral breast cancer, and that would also be substantially higher than the average population, and discuss the possibility of bilateral mastectomy for both management of this cancer as well as risk reduction for the future as an option.
So just to be clear, though, then double mastectomy but no neoadjuvant therapy?
Oh, no, still certainly we still would have recommended preoperative therapy. This patient has node-positive disease. We want to try to downstage the axilla and try to avoid a lymph node dissection if we can. So there's still a benefit to giving preoperative therapy in the triple-negative patient, even if she's going to have a bilateral mastectomy. You have a benefit to downstaging the axilla, and you also, again, have the benefit of being able to assess the response to treatment to determine if this is a patient who would potentially benefit from additional therapy after standard dose-dense ACT.
I think that is an important point in terms of, you know, I think what I see in terms of, you know, surveying people is that a big motivation to give neoadjuvant therapy, and particularly triple negative, HER2 positive, is the local procedure itself, avoidance of axillary dissection, maybe making the primary surgery more favorable. Is that your thought?
Absolutely. As I tell my patients, if my medical oncology colleague is going to recommend that they receive systemic therapy, that we have the opportunity to get sort of that secondary benefit or that bonus from it by using it before surgery, again, potentially downstaging the breast, potentially downstaging the axilla. So, of course, I would never encourage someone to take chemotherapy just for that benefit, but if they're going to receive it anyways, then there's really no disadvantage to using it up front to try to get those secondary benefits.
So let's finish out. We were talking about Oncotype earlier and genomic assays, and you have patients who got recurrence scores of 18, starting out with your 45-year-old woman. She was premenopausal?
Yes. 45-year-old premenopausal patient presented with a clinical T1 N0 IDC, which was grade 2 ERPR positive, HER2 negative. She was a good candidate for breast conservation therapy. And in that grade 2 disease, even though she's a young woman, there's not always a knee-jerk reaction that she would need chemotherapy. And so our oncologists, again, they like us to go to the operating room, get the information about the lymph nodes, and then this is a patient that would meet the criteria for our reflex testing to help in her systemic therapy decision. So she had a lumpectomy, a sentinel node biopsy. Pathology was a 1.5 centimeter grade 2 cancer, clear margins, and 0 of 3 sentinel nodes positive. And we sent off the recurrent score, and she has a score of 18. And so this is someone that our oncologist would feel very comfortable with just hormonal therapy alone. They would generally not be adding ovarian suppression at the score of 18, but certainly they would discuss the TAILORx data with patients and why they would not be strongly encouraging that. But feeling very comfortable again with the young patient and using the recurrent score to really sort out who needs additional systemic therapy and who can be treated with hormonal therapy alone.
So now this patient at 18, would that have fit into TAILORx intermediate?
It would have, because TAILORx, the low risk cutoff was at 11. And so then it was 12 to 25. So a quite wide range was intermediate in TAILORx. And we've seen, of course, now, you know, the breakdown of that group now between 11 and 18 and 18 to 25 in these young women, where they're looking at the absolute benefits. What is the absolute benefit achieved by adding chemotherapy on top of hormonal therapy? In these subsets, again, trying to make sure that we're not missing a subset that might potentially benefit.
There was a suggestion that chemotherapy benefited the younger women, the premenopausal women, which is the first time I've seen their correlation meaning menopausal status, and a lot of speculations about why. You mentioned ovarian suppression. But the other thing that has been talked about, and again was presented as ASCO, is where clinical risk fits in. So if this lady, instead of having a 1.5 centimeter tumor, had a 3 or 3.5 centimeter tumor, how would you have approached it?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think that, yes, factoring in the clinical risk helps you sort of make more nuanced decisions, again, within this wide range of intermediate risk. And if she had a bigger tumor, highly likely that our oncologist would have been talking about ovarian suppression in addition to hormonal therapy. Again, the impact by menopausal status suggests to us that some of that impact from chemotherapy is likely the result of chemotherapy-induced amenorrhea. And so therefore, we have data from other studies, TEXT and SOFT, et cetera, that adding OS to high clinical risk patients does improve outcomes. And so if her tumor was 3 centimeters, Oncotype score of 18, I suspect that hormonal therapy plus ovarian suppression would have been strongly recommended.
Well, the other thing, you know, we saw this little bit of a clinker in the younger women, but in the postmenopausal women, it seemed like there was no benefit going up to 25. Is that your take?
Absolutely. And so again, that's wonderful news for those women. No question about avoiding chemotherapy up to 25.
And then the other thing about it is, again, when they looked at clinical risk in the postmenopausal women, my read on that was if this patient had been postmenopausal, for example, or a patient like that, who had, I think their cutoff was 3 centimeters, so I don't know, 3 to 4 centimeter tumor, it still looked like they weren't benefiting from chemo. Again, was that your take?
Yes, agree. Mm-hmm.
So again, the old biology over anatomy story. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update, Surgical Edition.